Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Tzadi Amud Bet, four lines from the bottom. Shala Cleopatra Malkutoit Rabbi Meir. So Cleopatra, who is a figure in history that we know, here we have her interacting with Rabbi Meir, questioning Rabbi Meir. It's not clear whether she spoke directly to Rabbi Meir or it was done through an emissary. Cleopatra is the Ptolemaic ruler in Egypt at the time. She marries into the Roman Empire and joins Egypt into the Roman Empire and is a central figure in the Roman Empire. So she has a question for Rabbi Meir. It's included here because of the nature of the question has an impact on our views about some of the fundamentals of the faith, and we'll see other questions like that. So Shalak Cleopatra Malkutai Rabbi Meir. Amra Yadano Dechai Shachve. I know for certain that the dead will come to life. So she takes it as a given that Tchiyat HaMitim will take place, which is opposed to some of the questioners beforehand who were challenging whether there is Tchiyat HaMitim in the Torah. Over here, she accepts Tchiyat HaMitim, Dichtiv, because it says in the Tehillim about David's prayer for Shlomo's succession to the throne, Vayatzitzu Meir Ke'isiv Ha'aretz, that they will flourish, appear, will blossom, emerge from the city, like the grass of the earth, means that the dead, or those that will come to life, will emerge from the ground. They come back to life, do they come clothed or not clothed? It is a logical argument from that of a wheat seed or wheat kernel. Machita shenikberet aruma. If you plant the kernel of wheat, when it emerges, it's wrapped up in many different wrappings, but the idea being that it does not emerge looking like the kernel that was put in, but rather as a stalk, and it has all the things that cover up the wheat kernels that are in the new stalk of wheat. Tzadikim shenikbarim belubushim. Tzadikim who are buried in their clothing, alachat kama v'kama, certainly when they emerge from the ground, they will be clothed. So it's an interesting question that Cleopatra asks Rabbi Meir. Again, if you had one question to ask, I'm not sure that would be the only question you would ask. But here, they're dealing with a question that assumes or even accepts that there is Tchiyat HaMitim. That might be part of why the question is mentioned at all. It's because you see here someone who wasn't Jewish, clearly accepting the fact that there was Tchiyat HaMitim. She was just questioning, how is it going to come about? What are our expectations when the Meitim arise? The question might stem from the fact that Esav in the Pasuk implies that they come out naked, but that would be unbecoming. Or the question might revolve around whether creation is like the original creation of man, which was they were naked, below Bashashu, or is it the way that they lived and conducted their lives in clothing? So is it the pre or post Gan Eden man? So Amalei Keza the Rabban Gamliel, Amritu Dishachve Chayei. You say that those that are dead, that passed away, will come to life. Hahavu Afra. They are the dirt of the earth. Ve'afra mikachaye. And since when does dirt of the earth then become a human being? So what he is pointing out, which is a difficulty with regards to Tchiyat HaMitim, is the decomposition of the individual. The person's buried, over time they decompose. If that's the case, then how do you have Tchiyat HaMitim if the bodies are no longer intact? It might be that the skeletons are intact, but the bodies themselves are not intact. Even sometimes the skeletons are not intact. Then how do you have Tchiyat HaMitim from now what is decomposed material? And again, when the Gemara uses the term Kesar, it's not clear that we're speaking about literally the Caesar or the provincial governor of Judea who interacted with the Chachamim or the political echelons of the Jewish nation. Rabban Gamliel is one of the Nisi'im, and therefore he would have had interactions with the Roman government. And so the Caesar could refer to the person who sat in Caesarea, the Roman provincial leader, governor of the area. Amrele brate shavke v'ana mehadanerle. His daughter says, let it go, I'll take care of it, I'll answer it. Rashi over here says it's the daughter of the Caesar. The daughter of the Kesar says to Rabban Gamliel, back off, I'll handle this question. It's interesting only because why would she have any vested interest in answering the question or dealing with this issue? You could argue, unlike Rashi, that Amrle Brate is the daughter of Rabban Gamliel, said, let me handle this situation. And we'll see similar genres of answers like that later on, where someone who is not considered to be the leader or the head of the generation, answers the question and says, let me have a shot at answering this question. So that is possible also. Either way, this is the answer. Shnei yotzrim yesh b'ireinu. We have two craftsmen in our city. Echad yotzer min ha-mayim. One of them is able to create kelim, utensils from water. Echad yotzer min ha-tit. And the other one is able to do it from some mud or cement or plaster mixture, is able to create things. Ezman mishubach. Which one of them would you say is a greater craftsman? Amar la, zesh yotzer min ha-mayim. Of course, the one who creates from water. Anybody can create from water. That's pretty amazing that you can do anything with water and make it into a kli. You're talking about composite materials. You're talking about teat, some sort of plaster or earth and water mixture. There certainly, it makes sense that you could form that into a kli. Water has no form to it, so the person who can make that into a kli obviously is a great craftsman. So Amra Lei, so she says back, Minamayim tsar, minatit lo koshakein. If God can create through the water, then certainly he can create through the tit. If the craftsman can work out of water and create things out of water, then certainly he can create things out of solid material. And what she is saying is, the human being who's created comes from a conception that involves a, the way that the Gemara terms it in other places, a tipas rucha, comes from a little drop that rots, meaning that semen that fertilizes the woman. There you have a little drop of water that is then formed into a human being. So if God can create man through the process of conception, then certainly he should be able to create it from the afar, from the earth or the dirt that's there. It's much harder to create a person from one drop than it is to create them from physical material like afar. That's her answer is, if God can create man in the first place through a tipas rucha, then certainly it's chiyat ha-meitim to gather together some afar and to make them into man is not such a big deal, should not be beyond God's capabilities. The Beit Rabbi Shmuel Tana, kavachomer mikli zuchuchit. It's actually a kavachomer, logical argument from glass utensils. Makli zuchuchit she'amalam biruach, basar v'dam, that when you form glass, you do it through blowing. Interesting enough, Rashi says that's what I hear from the umanim, from the craftsmen. Rashi had not witnessed this or didn't know how glass was created. And he says, I talked to the craftsmen and they tell me that that's how glass is made, through blowing of glass. So if you form glass that are created through the blowing of the air of an individual, nishbiru, if they break, yesh lehem takana, they can be fixed, they can be refired. And that glass that breaks, even though it's not easy to fix the glass itself, you can't reheat it, melt it down to a molten state, and then recreate the glass again. Basar v'dam, human beings, shibiruchos shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that they have the breath of life put into them by God, al achad kama v'kama, certainly when they are nishbar, when they're broken, then they can be put back together, they can be recycled. So when you speak about glass that is formed through the blowing of air into the glass, and then when they break, they can be recycled. And certainly a human being that is created by the breath of God, then when they break down, they can be recycled or recreated. So again, there, that's a proof that Hashem should have no problem recreating individuals through Tkiyat HaMeitim, even though they've decomposed over time. Amalei hau mina l'Rabbi Ami. So this min says to Rabbi Ami, after the censorship of the Gemara, it's unclear what the word should be over here, or what was put here originally. Generally, it means someone who is not of the faith, but it means that someone that might have originally been from the faith and then left the faith. So that could be a kofar. That could be someone who's converted to another religion, which at that time most prominently would have been Christianity. But someone like that is questioning Rabbi Ami. You say that the dead come to life. They are decomposed. They're dirt of the earth. Since when does dirt of the earth rise in a resurrection? I'll give you a parable. The Melech Basar Vadam, a king, Shemar Labadav, Luchu Bnuli, Paltarin Gidolim, build me this tremendous palace, B'makom Shein Mayim Vafar, in a place where there's no water and there is no earth, meaning that they are missing the raw materials that you normally would need in order to put together a palace to build and to sustain the ability to put up construction in that location. They succeeded. They did what he asked them, despite the lack of raw materials They were able to do that. So much reminds you of Masada that's built in a place or a location that doesn't have many of the raw materials that you need. They all had to be brought up and shipped up there. So that's the idea. You build a palace somewhere where you don't have the natural raw materials. The Yamim Naflu. After some period of time, the palace collapsed. Go ahead and rebuild it in a place where they do have these raw materials. Amrulo, inanu yucholim. We can't. We don't have the ability to do that. Kasalim, v'marlehen, b'makom shein mayim v'afar benitem. In a place where there was no raw materials, there was nothing there, you succeeded at building it. Shav sheish mayim v'afar alachat kama v'kamo. Over here, where you have the raw materials in hand, certainly you should be able to build it. So here, the mashal is that either one of two ways to read it, either that they built it in a place where there's no raw materials, it falls and collapses, and it says rebuild it from the building that was already there. All that's there, reuse it, recycle it, and rebuild a building, and they say we can't do it. He says, wait, when you started out originally, there was nothing here and you're able to do it. Now that you have all these materials that are sitting there, you certainly should be able to do it. That's one possibility. Or the other possibility is they built it in a place where there was no raw materials. Now he's asking them to build it in another location that has them on site, the raw materials. They certainly should be able to do that. And that's, again, similar to the answer of the daughter of the Kesar, the daughter of Rabban Gamliel, which is here you have the ability, see in Rashi, the human being originally is created from a small drop of semen. And certainly, you should be able to create him from afar. Inami kol olam kulo yatzar mito. Or, it's a bigger picture. God created the world from nothing. We just read Parshat Bereishit. So God created it from tohu. Certainly now, when he has the raw materials in hand, he can create whatever it is that he needs to create. So for one of those two statements, what he's saying is that the original creation of man, either at the beginning of the world, or when a person is born, both of those creations are much more sophisticated and entail much more than simply gathering together what you have, the raw materials, whether that's a world that's already created, or a human being that's passed away and decomposed afar. Both of those are much easier to put together than the original creation of man. V'yitamamin, if you don't believe what I'm saying is true, say lebika, go out into the valley, v'ra'ach bar, go see there a mouse, I'm loosely translating it that way, shayom chetzio basar v'chetzio adama. Today, half of the body is flesh, the other half is the earth. L'machar, he shrits v'naseh kulo basar. Come back tomorrow, it emerges and the entire thing is basar. Shemu tomar l'mizman meruba. Say maybe that takes time, and therefore tchiyat mitim can't take place in an instant because there's a development time. So now with regards to the achbar over here, there are different ways to deal with this. One way is just to acknowledge the fact that Chazal believed or had some connection to the beliefs of the time that there was a concept called spontaneous generation, which is later disproved by the fact that if you cover meat, then you don't get maggots. In their time, it was believed the reason that maggots emerged from meat was because the meat turned into maggots, not because they came from the outside, until Francesco Redi covers the meat and shows that maggots can't appear when the meat is not exposed to the outside elements. But that means at their time, it's very common belief in spontaneous generation. And we find, not only here, the Gemara and Megillah, find in other places, Chazal speaking about the concept of spontaneous generation. And that seemingly is what is being described here. You see a mouse that emerges today, half basar. The next day he comes out and he's fully basar. He's emerging from the ground. In all likelihood, that's not a mouse that we know. That's why I was said, I translate the Akhbar loosely as a mouse. In all likelihood, it's something along the lines of a snail or a worm of some sort that emerges from the ground, or something that goes through a metamorphosis, like a caterpillar that turns into a butterfly. Whatever it is that is going on that they viewed as being some form of spontaneous generation. Again, when it comes to these concepts within Chazal, it's important to note that they have misorot about certain things of Torah Sh'bal Peh, but they are also influenced by the science of their times and that which was known to people at that time. Sometimes it's hard to discern when the Gemara is speaking, whether they're speaking with an eye to misorah or they're speaking with an eye to the knowledge of the time. And so since those are unclear in the Gemara, they're conflated, it's hard to know sometimes whether they're speaking from a Torah Baal Peh perspective or from a knowledge of their time. It's clear that they're influenced by the knowledge of the time. This might be one of those cases where they're influenced by the fact that there is spontaneous generation. They're not speaking about some halakhic issue or some misorah. He's trying to prove to Amin that there's tchiyat ha-meitim, and he points to something scientific at their time where things emerge from the ground and they turn into a live being. So why can't human beings be the same thing? That's what he's pointing out to them. So then he says, and if you think that that takes time to happen, ale lahar ure, go up to the mountain and take a look. Shayom ein bo lechila zon echad. Today there's only one, whether it's a worm or snail there. The machar yerdu gishamim. Tomorrow the rains will fall. When it malei kulo chilzonot, and all of a sudden there's plenty of snails or worms that are up there. That might be the result of the fact that when it rains, it forces the worms to the surface, or it forces the snails to the surface, and therefore they appear. The way that he is terming it here is that the rain itself causes the emergence of these items, as if they're being created from the ground, from the rain that comes. But that's instantaneous. I mean, you go today and there's one, you come tomorrow and there are tons of them. Now, whether that's the hatching of eggs, which is a possibility that Rashi mentions from his Ribbeim, or the emergence of the snails from their shells, it could be a time period where it happens. Rashi indicates that these snails in this Chila zone is the one associated with the production of Tchelet. Over here he says that they are brought there by the Yam, although in the Gemara in Menachot, Rashi says that they emerge from the ground or from the Aretz and not the Yam. All of these are possibilities, or it could be a belief in spontaneous generation. No matter what it is, what he's trying to point out to the mean is that you do see this idea that life can come about in a very short period of time and it emerges. But go up there at one point, you see no life, and then you come back and it's teeming with life. So you see that there can be instantaneously, God can create, and he can create from the earth itself. It can become merging from the ground itself. No different than Tchiyat HaMeitim, where God in an instant can bring back the life and have the individuals emerge from the ground. Woe to you that you should be condemned. Damritun mite chayin, that you say the dead come to life. Techayin mete, those that are alive die. De mete chayin, you're going to tell me those that are dead are going to come to life. In the natural course, what happens in life is everyone dies. So that's a given. Now, you're going to try to say that they're going to have something that's opposite the nature of the world, which is now all of a sudden the dead are going to come to life. Anybody who's alive dies. Nobody who's dead comes to life. And now you're going to tell me that there is Tchiyat HaMeitim. So Amar Lei, so now Gvia ben Psisa responds to this min. Vaylechon chayavaya, woe to you, those that are condemned or those who have the wrong beliefs. Damitun meite lo chayin. You said that those that are dead can't come to life. The lohavu chaye, we know that life is created from something that was never life before. The original creation of man or conception of man, when a man and woman have a child, that child never lived before. And they're able to now become a human being and a living being. Dahavu chaye lo koshikein, but they were once alive. And now they would come back to life. So over here, you're saying to me, it can't be that the dead will come to life. And he responds to him, listen, people who are never alive are made into live beings, then certainly people that were once alive should be able to be returned to being human beings. It should be easier to resurrect an individual who was once alive than it is to create life from nothing or start a new life entirely. Amalei, chayavaya karit li. Now the min says back to Gvia ben Psisa, you called me someone who is culpable, someone should be condemned. If I get up, I would give you a swift kick. And therefore I would straighten out your hunchbackedness here. Amalei, so Gvia ben Psisa says back to him, if you do such a thing, you'll be considered an expert doctor. And you can charge a lot of money for that because you could straighten out my hunchbackedness. So it seems from here that Gvia ben Psisa was a hunchback, or he had some sort of physical deformity that caused him to be bent over or not look so normal. And therefore the min is saying to him, being offended by the fact that Gvia ben Psisa called him a chayavaya, even though the min himself called Gvia ben Psisa that name, when he responded and called him that name, he took offense to it. And then in taking offense to it, he says something that indicates to us the physical stature of Gib Hissisa was somehow compromised. And then he says, if I kick it, I'd straighten you out. And then Gib Hissisa, in a joking manner, says back to him, well, that'd be great. Then you'd be a terrific doctor. You would have solved the problems that I have. Now, Gvia ben Psisa seemingly is a Talmud Chacham. We're going to see that from the upcoming Gemarot, that he is a Talmud Chacham. But it seems like he never either got smicha or sat as a Dayan or amongst the Chachamim because of the physical deformity that he had. That somehow precluded him from joining the ranks of the Chachamim, even though generally what we're looking for is erudition and knowledge and the ability to learn Torah. Nevertheless, we know that there are physical mumim that disqualify an individual from serving in the Mikdash as a Kohen, as well as serving as a Dayan, that the Gemara darshins from when Moshe Rabbeinu puts the Dayanim in place, that they have to be Dome le Moshe, which means that they both have to have that erudition, but they also have to be people who don't have a physical deformity necessarily. And that might be what precluded Gvia ben Psisa from being a Dayan or being amongst the Chachamim. We're going to see that in the upcoming story, that he plays a role in a number of interactions. Tanabanan. B'srivarba b'nisan, the Gemara is quoting Megillat Tanit. Megillat Tanit is replete with stories and dates of situations in which the Jews were victorious, whether it was in theological arguments or whether it was in battles. And Megillat Tanit sets up all these dates as dates that where you can't fast, you can't eulogize. They were mini holidays that were around the year during Bayit Sheni from the successes of the Jewish government or the Chachamim at that time. So here it's quoting from Megillat Tanit about an incident on Esrim Varba B'Nisan, the 24th of Nisan, in Tilu Dimusnai Miuda Yerushalayim. They kicked out the demon Osai from Yehuda and Yerushalayim. The demon Osai, it's not clear exactly what their position is, but it seems to be that they were tax collectors or land authorities. And so they both determined the title to the land, as well as collected taxes from whoever held the title of the land. So these Dumanusnai that were in Yehuda and Yerushalayim were expelled. And here's the incident. Shubo bnei Afrikaya ledunim Yisrael. The people of Africa came to a adjudication against the Jewish nation. So it's like the international court where nations are coming to sue each other, not where it's individuals that are coming. They came with Nei Alexandros Mokdon for Alexander the Macedonian, who is Alexander the Great, had conquered the vast areas, including the area of Eretz Yisrael. We have a story later on in the Perek Achelek, where he meets with the Kohen Gadol, Alexander Mokdon. And we know in general, based on the stories here in Perek Achelek, that he was favorably disposed in general towards the Jews. Later on, when the empire gets split between his three generals, it deteriorates and then finally leads to Antiochus and the decrees against the Jews at the time of Hanukkah. But in its outset, when Alexander the Macedonian comes, he is respectful and even gives a certain amount of reverence towards Judaism. Later on, the Gemara tells a story where he had seen the image of the Kohen Gadol when he went out to battle. And therefore, when he met him, he gave tremendous respect because he thought that that was one of the reasons he was successful in his battles. So here they bring the case before Alexander the Great. Amalo, Eretz Kanan Shalanuhi. They make the claim that we really own the land of Israel. So whether that was brought by the people of Africa, or it is these land authorities that are in Israel that are now making a claim on behalf of the African nations, or even without the African nations, they're just trying to kick the Jews out of their land and disown them from the land. And they say, Eretz Kanan is ours. Dichtiv, Eretz Kanan ligvudotah. It says Eretz Kanan and its borders. Uchanan abuon danu inchiabu. Kanan is the forefather of these individuals. So the basic claim is that the Jews stole it from the Canaanites. They conquered it. They expelled the Canaanites from Canaan. Now, the truth is, Alexander the Great is only there because he conquered Canaan and he conquered all these areas. Somewhat ironic that they're bringing a case about conquest in front of Alexander the Great, whose ownership of all these properties or his rulership was all governed by kibush, with conquest. So what you have to say here is that their claim is one of two reasons. One of which is, Eretz Canaan, mentioned in the Torah, calls it Eretz Canaan. The Torah does not call it Eretz Yisrael until much later. It calls it Eretz Canaan. The fact that the Torah continues to refer to it as Eretz Canaan shows or indicates that it really belongs to Canaan and not to the Jews or Yisrael. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that, yes, the Jews conquered Eretz Yisrael, and therefore they could have kept it. But then they were expelled from Eretz Yisrael. Once they were expelled from Eretz Yisrael, their conquest was no longer meaningful. Now they're returning. That is, they return in the time of Bayit Sheni, when the Persian Media Empire, Cyrus, gives them permission to return, and later on, Darius gives them permission to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. So there, they were permitted by the government authorities to do that, based on their original claim to the land, which is that they had conquered the land, lost it, now they're giving it back. Canaanites say, wait, if you're giving it back based on precedent, we have an earlier precedent. So right, you're right. One, they conquered it, they had it. But then they lost that conquest. Now they were allowed to come back. Now that they come back, we have an earlier claim to the land because we were here first. If you're going to give it back to the person who was here first, give it back to us, not to the Jews. Interestingly enough, today, it's the same claim made about the Jews when they returned to Israel and said, we have the rights to the land. The Arabs say, what are you talking about? If you want to say you have rights to the land, we've been here for so many years. We have an earlier claim to the land. The Jews retort and say that's not the case. We have a much earlier claim because of Tanakh. We have a much earlier claim to the land. That's why there is a systematic effort by many of those to eliminate any evidence of Jewish sovereignty, whether it's over Har HaBayit, where they try to destroy any of the antiquities that are there, or in other places where they try to deny the Jewish connection to the land. That is the efforts that are made in the UN today to say that Jerusalem is not really a city that belongs to the Jews, or it's not really a Jewish city in its origins. All that is to disconnect the fact that the Jews were here first and that they have an earlier connection to the land. Over here, the Canaanites are making a similar claim here, which is, if you're going to use earlier claims, we have the earliest claim. Amar lehu, Gvia ben Psisa lechachamim. Gvia ben Psisa says lechachamim, Tnu li reshut, ve'lech ve'doni mehem, lifnei Alexandros Mokdon. Let me go be the representative, the Jewish representative, emissary, to go argue the case before Alexander the Great. Iminitz chuni, if they win the case, Amru, ejol shibanu nitzachtem. You can say, you know what, you guys won, but we sent one of our second string guys, and that's why you won. Our first string guys will come now and we'll take care of the situation. If I'm successful at winning the argument against them, we'll say that the Torah of Hashem was successful at winning. So first of all, he's a very interesting individual, self-deprecating in many ways, where he's saying here, listen, if I win, we'll give all the credit to the Torah. If I lose, you'll just say I'm a regular guy, and, you know, we'll send our first string now. It's interesting, I don't know if that type of argument would work. Alexander the Great would say, well, if you knew it was a big case, why don't you send your first string in the first place? But anyway, he was giving them a chance to have an out, and obviously the Chachamim had confidence in this individual, Gvia Psisa, and that's what I said before, that he must have been a Talmud Chacham, he must have been on par with the Talmidei Chachamim of the time, the fact that they're willing to send him to be the emissary of the Jews to argue this case. He must have been erudite and as well as articulate, because otherwise they couldn't send him to speak before Alexander the Great. Despite his physical ailment or deformity, he was still able to argue on behalf of the Jews. That might have been the argument that he was offering, which is, if you send me there, my appearance is enough to say that I'm a second string guy or just a regular guy, and we didn't send our first string. So Natnu lo reshut v'alach. They gave him permission to go and appear before Alexander the Great to argue on behalf of the Jews. The Dani Mehem, and this is the adjudication that took place. Amar lehem, meichan atem mevi'im raya? Where are you bringing your proof from? Amar lo, min haTorah. From the Torah. Amar lehem, af ani lo avi lachem raya, ela min haTorah. So I'll answer you based on the proofs that you're bringing from the Torah. So it's similar to the Christian-Jewish debates that took place, where most of the arguments revolved around Tanakh and arguments from the Psukim, and whether you can prove or disprove things from the Psukim themselves. They're both working with the same source. It's the same thing over here. Shenemar, because it says, Vayomer, Arur Kanan, Eved Avadim, Yadei Chav, that Kanan is cursed. This is in the time of Noach, after Cham takes advantage of Noach, and then afterwards, Shem and Yafet take care of their father. The curses, Canaan, who was the fourth child of Cham, and says that he will be an eved, he will be a slave or a servant to his brothers, his brethren, which are Shem and Yafet. Eved shekana nechasim, an eved that has possessions. Eved lemi, who does the slave or the servant belong to? Nechasim lemi, and who does the possession belong to? So meaning that we have the principle, mashakana eved, kana rabo. So here, you're right. Maybe Canaan did have the rights to the land, but he is an eved to Shem. If that's the case, then whatever he acquired, whatever possessions he had, would go to his master, Shem. Blood. Shereish kamashanim shalavatunu. Wait a minute. Besides that, you guys have shirked your responsibility. And you haven't been working for us. You haven't been our slaves or servants for many years. Amalan, Alexandros, Malko. So Alexander the Great says to them, Exiru lo tshuva. Answer him. Give him a response to what he just said. Amrlo, tsulanu zman shloshe yamim. Give us 3 days to consider the matter. Tanlem zman, he did give him that amount of time. Again, we find that in many stories in the Gemara, as well as in later debates, that 3 days was the amount of time that was given as a preparation time. If you read in the introduction to the Netana Tokef, there, they also describe that he asked for 3 days to consider what to do. We find other situations like that. It's a very common amount of time or window of time that's given as preparation. But ku velo matzu tshuva. They looked into the matter and they didn't have a winning response against what Gvia Bem Sisa said. Miad barchu, they ran away. Beinichu sadutehem, and they left their fields kashen druot, when they were planted, v'kameyem kashen yituot, their vineyards which were laden, botu shana shvi'it haita. And that year happened to be a Shemitah year. Now this has interesting implications. The first of which is, you see that these people resided amongst the Jews. They were in Israel. So even though this is a claim by African nations for the land of Israel to take Canaan, nevertheless, the people that are making the claim are people who are present in Israel, because now when they abandon ship, they basically are, their properties are taken over by the Jews that are there and then used because it is a Shemitah year. That's number one. That's what I said before, that these seem to be some sort of land authorities or tax authorities that are in Israel, and they're trying to confiscate more land or deny the Jews ownership or title to the land. And then when they lose the battle, they take off because they're now going to be subject to punishment or the wrath of Alexander the Great for bringing up a topic and being disproven in that topic. That's number one. Number two is, you see here the difficulty of Shemitah. Today, as difficult as Shemitah is, it's still much easier than it was in their day. Today we have refrigeration. Refrigeration means that we're able to store items for much longer periods of time. In their day, 3 days after the Shemitah began, vegetables were basically gone from the marketplace. You couldn't get vegetables for the entire next year. Vegetables have a very short shelf life. Without refrigeration, there's very little to do besides fresh vegetables. Once you cross over a certain period of time, then the vegetables are based on the kita, I'm being picked, and if they're picked in Shemitah, then they are Shemitah vegetation, and you are then stuck for the rest of the remainder of the year where you're not going to really have fresh vegetation, or everything that you pick is going to be Shemitah produce. And subject to the Gzeira of Sfichim, which turns out to be a very, very difficult Gzeira, which causes a lot of this difficulty in being Shomer Shemitah, this Gzeirat HaSfichim, and then you have these miraculous events that end up saving them in the years of the Shemitah, because the Gzeirat HaSfichim makes every Shemitah vegetation that is past that certain threshold be considered or classified as Sfichim. That's number one. Number two is the fact that we have Otzer Beitin, which supposedly comes out of Tosefta and was a practice of their time. Still, no matter what you say about the Otzar Beitin, whether they had it or they didn't have it, it certainly was not sufficient to supply everybody that was there. And you see here that they specifically speak about an incident in which the fields were left laden with items to eat in the Shemitah year. And that tells you of the generally desperate straits of the individuals during the Shemitah year. We have other stories like this in Tosefta as well, where they were basically starving because it was the Shemitah year. And then miraculously, they had some sort of army that came and dropped off food or was kicked out, and they had all this food that came about. The Shemitah was extremely difficult and a Mesirat Nefesh to keep Shemitah in their time versus today, where it's a big Mesirat Nefesh, but nothing like it was in their day. And that's indicated through here, through the great excitement that was associated with the fact that they were kicked out and they left them all this produce during the Shemitah year. So again, this goes back to Megillat Tanit, which this was a huge victory for the Jews in that day, and therefore they commemorated it with a quasi-holiday that was on the day that's delineated in Megillat Ta'anit. It's a day that they can't eulogize, they can't fast, because it was a celebratory day. Alright, so now we have Shuv Pamachat. It seems like the word Pamachat shouldn't be. Shuv Bo'u Bnei Mitzrayim. Adonim Yisrael Lefnei Alexandros Mokdon. So another international court hearing in front of Alexander the Great, where the Egyptians come, make a claim against the Jews. Amr lo, Arei Omer, Torah says, Vashem Natan et Chena Am Beinei Mitzrayim. Hashem gives the Jews a certain amount of chen and charm in the eyes of Mitzrayim. Vayashilum. And therefore they lent them their possessions on the way out. It says, Brunan HaKesef Zav Shnatalta Mimenu. Egyptians say, you walked out with all of our stuff, never returned it. Pay up. It says here you borrowed it. Why aren't you repaying it? Amar Gvia ben Psisa, again, the same story again. Gvia ben Psisa says, Chamim tuni rishut ve'lech aduni mehem. Ben Alexandros, imi nitzachuni amru lehem edyot shebanu nitzachtem. If they win, just say, you guys beat one of our little guys, one of our second string guys. V'imani natzeach utam amru lehem torat Moshe Rabbeinu nitzachtem. So if I have succeeded, then it's the Torah that succeeds, not the law. Rishut v'alach v'adani imahem. They give permission to go and argue the case. Amr lehem. Ve'ichan atem ivin raya amru lo min ha-Torah. Amr lehem afani lo avi lachem raya lo min ha-Torah. Also bring a proof from the Torah. Shneamar. Moshe b'nei Yisrael asher yishvu b'mitzrayim 30 shana v'arba me'od shana. They were there 430 years enslaved. Tunu l'nanu schar avodah shel 60 ribo. Sheshibadtem b'mitzrayim 30 shana v'arba me'od shana. It's easy. Just give us the pay for the enslavement of the Jews in Mitzrayim. That's 600,000 times 430 years. You got a big bill to pay now. Why you guys come with a claim against us? I think we have a bigger claim than you do. Amalei Alexandros Mokdon, Exirolo Tshuva. Answer, respond to him. Amalelo, Tzmulan Hasman, Shloshe Yamim. Give us 3 days. Natan Lehem Zman, he gave him the 3 days. But Kubalo Matzu, Tshuva. They didn't find anything. Miyari Nichu, Sududem, Kishen Zrod, Kamehem, Kishen Netuot, Tuparchu, Botar Shana, Shmiit, Haita. Similar case, where these people, or these people making the argument, live in Israel, and then they abandon ship when they lose the argument in front of Alexander Mokdon, where they were trying to dispossess the Jews of their land or take their money. When they lose the battle, they end up having to lose out on their own possessions or their own land. Now, interesting enough over here, this question is a pretty fundamental question in the Chumash, which is, why is that the case? Why did they mislead the Egyptians? Why did they lie to them and borrow the items and then walk off with them? Isn't that somewhat questionable type of behavior? And so many of the Rishonim on these psukim of Ayashilum tried to deal with why it was okay or what was justified in their action. The best answer that I really have seen is from Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who over there says that the word She'elah is mistranslated. He says that the word appears hundreds of times in Tanakh, and the word means the same thing in every place, with the exception of one or two places. And that is that the word she'ela does not mean to borrow. The word she'ela means to take as a gift, or to give something to someone. It's actually found in the Haftorah that we read on Rosh Hashanah by Chana and Elkanah, by the story of the birth of Shmuel. There she says that she named him Shmuel, that Hashem granted him to me, me'et Hashem. There are questions in the Mefarshim as to why she didn't call him Shaul and not Shmuel, and what is the interplay between the two individuals, Shmuel and Shaul. But over there, when it says Shaluni, we translate it as though he lent him to me, and therefore I'm returning him. That's not the case. The word there means that he gifted me a child. And that gift I'm now returning to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, when she goes and puts Shmuel in the Mikdash to live with Eli, a Kohen, and to become a Navi in the Mikdash. There are others, hundreds of examples where the word she'ela means a matana or a gift. The one place it does not mean that is actually in Parshat Mishpatim. In Parshat Mishpatim, it speaks about a shoel. There it's speaking about someone who's borrowing an item from another party. That is the location, the one place where the word she'ela means to borrow. And what Rav Shamshon Raphael points out is that we translate the word here based on that one place where it means to borrow, rather than the overwhelming majority of places in Tanakh where it means to gift or to take and not to borrow. And he says the word is just mistranslated. Vayashilum does not mean to borrow. It means to take. It means to be gifted something. And if you translate it properly, you won't have a question on the psukim or the behavior of the Jews. And that's his answer to this problem. which is look at the majority of instances where it appears, and not in the one case where it translates to mean to borrow. And now we have another incident. So now you have the Bnei Ishmael and Bnei Keturah. These are children of Abraham besides Yitzchak. Lifnei Alexandros Mokton, in front of Alexander the Great. Amrulo Eretz Kanan Shelanu, Vishalachem. So their claim wasn't that it exclusively belongs to us, as opposed to the Canaanites that made that claim, or the Mitzrim who are making a claim for compensation. They are just saying, we should share with you in Eretz Kanan. Tichtev, Ela Todot Ishmael ben Abraham. Tichtev, Ela Todot Yitzchak ben Abraham. We see that both Ishmael and Yitzchak were children of Abraham. If that's the case, we should be on equal footing. So again, let me go and make the argument in our favor. If they win, just say you won against one of our lay people. If I succeed, you can say that the Torah was successful. That he gave everything that he possessed to Yitzchak. And to the children of the maidservants, he gave gifts. Everybody else was a child of a maidservant, meaning that Yitzchak is born to his wife, Sarah. The Bnei Ishmael are born to Hagar, who was a maidservant of Sarah. And then Bnei Keturah are the wife that Abraham took after the passing of Sarah, with whom he has an additional 6 children. And there, the pasuk that we're reading over here is found, which is that Abraham gave gifts to those children that were born to Keturah. So if I take that statement, it says that Abraham gave them what they got, and now Yitzchak got what he got, which was at their colt. A father that gives over, Rashi translates the word Agdin as Ktavim, which is documents of ownership or title that indicate the possessions that each one is entitled to, and then he separates between them. Any of the parties have a claim against their fellow man, which is that he basically divides up his property in his lifetime. And he writes a documentation that indicates which property belongs to whom. And then he says, you guys are out on your own now. Nobody has any claims against each other. That's what happens. Avram over here gives Yitzchak a call. He gives the Bnei Melachim Matanot. And he basically sends them off. When he does that, he's indicating that each one of them got their possession. And there's no longer any sharing of the Yerusha. If that's the case, we don't have to give you anything from our Yerusha, which is the land of Israel, the land of Canaan. So my matanot, the Gemara here interjects in a second, it says, what are the gifts? That he gave over to them the concept of tumah. Rashi over here says, shem tumah is kishuf umaseh shedim. Witchcraft, sorcery, working with the demons, the dark powers, Avram gave over to them. It's interesting only because Kishuf is problematic. For a Jew, for sure it's problematic. It might even be a problem for a Ben Noach. And despite that fact, over here, Avram's gifting it to these individuals. So whether that means literally he gifted them these powers, which would be interesting in of itself, why did Avram gift them these powers? Is he giving them an alternative to monotheism? Seems strange since Avram is the advocate for monotheism, even for people who are not Jewish. So why would he give them over Shem Tuma? Or is he giving them over the capacity to understand these dark forces, which would give them the ability to be discerning and know when someone's telling the truth, or when someone's playing around with these dark forces, to actually reinforce within them monotheism by saying that when people come with these other things, they're false, or they're not real. You know, I'm explaining to you how the people can do these things, or how they can have these powers. Maybe that's what he was gifting to them. Again, Rashi quotes this Midrash Chazal on the Pasuk in Chumash to explain what he sent them off with. So now the Gemara here doesn't end like it ended in the other two cases, but I guess you could assume that the outcome was the same, which is Gbiya Psisa, that Psisa was successful at his argument, and therefore they won the case. Amalei Antoninus, the Rabbi. So we know of the relationship between Antoninus and Rabbi. He was the Roman governor of Judea, and he had a very close relationship with Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. It seems to be that it's Marcus Aurelius Rabbi had this relationship with, who was known as a philosopher as well as the emperor of Rome. He was generally a benevolent ruler and is considered to be the last of the five good emperors of Rome. There are stories throughout the Gemara of them eating together, doing things together. And here you have some philosophical conversations that take place between them, in which the interactions are both positive and both sides are contributing. Until now, we've had a questioner who was a denier, and then Chazal are trying to undermine that denial, and they're responding. Over here you have Antoninus asking questions, not to undermine, not to be a denier, but to understand. And then, both through Rabbi and Antoninus, they come to a conclusion to better understand these concepts. Which is, Guf and Neshama, Yecholim Liftor Atzman Min Adin. Antoninus says to Rabbi, the Guf and the Neshama can basically exempt themselves from punishment. Ketzat. Guf Omer, the Guf will say, the body will say, Neshama Chatat, that the Neshama was the thing that caused me to sin. I didn't do anything wrong. Since the day that the Neshama left me, I am still as a rock in my grave. I can't do anything. So the only reason I did anything in life was because of the Neshama. Without the Neshama, you see here, I'm just a rock in the ground. Neshama Omeret Guf Chatat. The Neshama says, it's the body that caused the sin. From the day that I left the body, for any Purachet Bavir Kitzipor, I'm flying around like a bird, like a free bird. I don't have any of these burdens. I'm not going after or doing anything wrong anymore. So each one independently can blame the other one for that which went wrong. So then, based on that, you should be able to exempt oneself from the judgment that Tidlavo when the Neshama and the Guf separate. So Amar Lei, Emsholecha Mashal. I'll answer your question, Rabbi says, by giving you a parable. Mashal Adama Davar Dome. What is this similar to? The Melech Basar V'dam, a king, Sheyelu Pradesh. Now, he had this beautiful orchard or vineyard, Vayobo Bichorot Naot, which Rashi says over here, Te'enei Bichorot. These are figs, or I don't know, the first figs are juicy figs, great figs in it. Voshibo Shnei Shomrim. And he puts two guards to guard the field. Echad Chider, one of them is lame, unable to walk. Echad Suman, one of them is blind, unable to see. But Pardes, the Chiger, who has eyesight but is unable to move, says, I can see beautiful fruit over here in this orchard. Bo v'yirkivani, let me ride on your shoulders. V'nivyeim lochlam, and we'll go grab them and we'll eat them. Rachab Chiger agavi suma. So then the Chiger gets on the shoulders of this suma of the blind person. V'yivyum v'achlom. They will ride them and they eat them. They start to enjoy all the fruits of the orchard. So basically, each one of them compensated for the deficit of the other. The blind person can't see. The chiger is able to see. The chiger can't walk, so the blind person puts him on his shoulders and it gives him legs to walk. So together they create a whole being which is able to benefit and get these wonderful fruits. Yamin ba bala pardes. So eventually the king shows up to see his orchard. Amar lahen b'chorot naot eichan hein. What happened to all the gorgeous fruit that's in this field? Or in this orchard. I don't see them here anymore. The Chiger says, I can't walk. It can't be me who took them. I can't get anywhere in order to take the fruits. The Suma says, I don't even know what's in the field. You're telling me that they're there. I can't even see the fruits to take them. Masa. So what does he do? He throws the lame person on top of the shoulders of the Suma. And then he judges them in one shot. He basically rejoins them in order to judge them. Similarly, God may be neshama b'zulka b'guf. He brings the neshama back and throws it into the body. And then he judges them together. Shneamar, yikrai l'shamayim al v'la'aretz l'din amo. So he calls out to the heavens above, v'la'aretz, and to the land, l'din amo, to avenge his nation. So now the Gemara Darshan, Ikra El Hashamayim Me'al, it calls up to the heavens above, Zo Neshama, that's a reference to the Neshama. Ve'el Aretz Ladin Amo, they Aretz to that which is below in order to avenge, Ze'a Guf, that's the body. So he calls for the Shamayim and the Aretz where the Guf is and the Shamayim where the Neshama is, and then Ladin Amo, then he judges them. So So God only judges them when he brings them back together, so they can't point fingers at each other, and basically makes them into a single entity again in order to judge them. Why does the sun rise in the east and set in the west? So Rabbi says back to him, says if it was the opposite, you would ask me the same question. If it rose in the west and set in the east, you'd ask me the same question. The question is not valid because no matter which way it was, you would have asked the question. He says, no, this is my question. Why does it set in the west? You could have had it set in the east. You could have it set in the west. Why does it pick to set in the west? So Amalei, Rabbi says back to him, "Kedei liten shalom lekoneh," so that he can bow down to his creator. Shnemar, Tzva Hashemayim lechamish tachavim, that the constellations, the luminaries, bow down to God. And so that's what the sun is doing. The Shekhinah is in the Marav, as Rashi says over here. And the sun sets as the Marav, as if it's bowing down to God on the western side. Now this goes back to the Gemarot that we saw in Baba Batra, as to where exactly the presence of the Shekhinah is, the Shekhinah in the east and the west. The Kodesh HaKodeshim in the Mikdash was towards the western side, and therefore there's a heavy bias to saying that the Shekhinah is in the west. And this Gemara seemingly, according to Rashi, follows that position, that the Shekhinah is in the west, and that's why the sun bows down and sets on the western side. Samalei, B'teiti Ad Pago Derikia, says it makes more sense than that the sun should go to the middle of the sky, V'titein Shalma, and then he should give greetings, meaning bow down to the king, V'teyu, and then set, basically, or disappear. So now, again, this seemingly is based on the Gemara's belief that there was a Rekia, firmament, that went over the earth. The sun came through the firmament and then travels along under the firmament to provide light to the earth. At the end of the day, it passes through the firmament and then goes back over the top of the firmament to return the next day. That explains the phenomenon that we see, which is that when the sun rises, you see light before the sun actually comes out. And at sunset, you see the sun disappear before the light disappears. They based that on the fact that the firmament had a certain amount of thickness to it. And as the sun entered into that passageway that led it through the firmament, it lit up the firmament, and that's what gives the light, whether at the sun rising or the sun setting time, even though the sun has disappeared from the horizon. In addition, there are what we call chalonot ha-rakia, the windows of the rakia. The windows are those passageways through which the sun goes, and that's what we say when we daven the chalonei rakia. So what he's suggesting is, if it's the case that you want to bow down to the king, then the proper etiquette in bowing down to an authority or a king is to bow from afar. You don't go all the way up to the king and bow down right in front of him. The person bows down at a distance. That's showing reverence for the king is when you bow down from a distance. He says, what I don't understand is, why does the sun set on the western side? Why doesn't it just go to the middle of the sky? And when it's done bowing down, it should just go through the firmament and disappear, basically set in the middle of the sky. It wouldn't be set anymore. It would be just disappearing in the middle of the sky. It would go through the firmament at that point. Makes sense that it rose in the east, came towards God, but it reached a point where it'd be appropriate for it to bow down and then disappear. So that's his question to Rabbi. Mishom po'alim mishum ha'ovrei drachim. Because that would create a great inconvenience for the workers and for the travelers. This is similar to what the Gemara says about death, which is that Yaakov Avinu prayed that a person should get sick first and then pass away. Because otherwise people had no preparation or indication that if someone's about to expire, they would just sneeze and then they would pass away. Nobody had any notice of the person. So Yaakov Avinu prays that people should get sick and they should deteriorate in a slower fashion so that there's indication of the death coming, they can prepare. They themselves can prepare as well as their relatives can prepare for the loss of that individual. So similarly over here, what he's saying is with regards to the sun. If the sun didn't do things in a gradual manner, it suddenly disappeared in the middle of the sky, it would give no heads up to the workers and to those that are traveling that the day is about to end. The fact that the sun moves across the horizon, goes from the east to the western side, gives the people an indication of the time of day. And so therefore, when it gets towards the lower side or setting on the western side, the workers know that the day is going to be over and they can start packing up their stuff and go in. And travelers know to start preparing that they're going to have to sleep here overnight. This is going to be the end of their traveling day. If it just went to the middle of the sky, then suddenly went through the rakia in the middle of the sky, then it would be hard to know when to prepare in a day for your night. meaning that they're going to stay over as a traveler or workers to go home. And so therefore, that's why it goes to the western side. At what point is the neshama, the life force, given to an individual? Mishat kida or mishat yitzira? Is it the time of conception, or is it at the time when the body is formed inside the womb of the woman? Or yitzira could also be possibly at the time of birth, when it's actually created. Amalei mishat yitzira. Rabbi says, from the time that the body is actually created, not from the time of conception. So Amalei efshar chatikah shel basar omedet shlosha yamin below melach, ve'ena masrechet. Tinos is speaking in his day where they had no refrigeration. Meat will not stay intact for more than 3 days unless it's heavily salted. Unless you preserve the meat by either drying it out or salting it, you cannot preserve meat more than 3 days. It will start to decompose. It will start to rot. Tonino says to Rabbi, can't be right. Says there's no being that can survive and be intact without a life force in it more than 3 days. And so he says, if you think it only happens mishat yitzira, that means from the time of conception to the time of yitzira, you have a body that is developing, you have basar, you have flesh that is there, and the flesh is not rotting despite the fact that there's no life force in it. He says, we know that there's no such thing. Anything lacking a life force begins to decompose within 3 days. So it says it's impossible, therefore it must be ela mishat kida, that the neshama goes into the individual from shat kida, from the moment of conception, and that's why it doesn't rot, it doesn't go bad, it's because there's a life force in it. Amar Rabbi, davar zeh lamdeini Antoninus. This I learned from Antoninus, umikra misayo, and the pasuk supports his position. So you see over here, again, this type of symbiotic relationship that's going on, where Rabbi and Antoninus are speaking. Antoninus is asking him questions, Rabbi responds, but Antoninus has a certain input into the outcome of the situation, and they have a discussion which leads to a better answer, and Rabbi says in the end that Antoninus was right. I was wrong, and actually the pasuk supports him, because it says, Shemar, ufukudatcha shamra ruchi. The pasuk, the pasuk is, ufkudatcha, your mitzvot, your commands have saved me or guarded my life. The way the Mar is reading it is, ufkudatcha, pkida, at the moment of conception, shamra ruchi. That's what keeps me intact. That's what keeps me from going bad. And that means that mishat pkida, from the moment of conception, there is a neshama. This discussion between Rabbi and Antoninus might have impact in terms of abortions and hapalat ubar. Because over here, depending on when you believe the life force goes into the baby, will be determinant as to whether it's considered to be problematic to abort the baby or not abort the baby. If you think that there is no life force in the creation, then it's not a life. And therefore aborting would be much easier. If you believe there's a life force in the entity from the very beginning, then it's much harder to argue that you're allowed to abort in those cases. So this, first of all, would have impact on that discussion, and it goes back to earlier in the Masechta where we discussed abortion and when is it allowed, not allowed. And again, for Ben Noach, it's considered to be murder, so it has significant impact as to when you think the individual takes on a life force. At what point does the Yetzara become a dominant force in the individual? Mishat Yetzira or Mishat Yetzia? Is it the time of the creation of the individual or the time that they emerge? So in this way, it would then indicate earlier when we said Yitzira, that Yitzira can't be the time of the birth of the baby, because over here they term that as Yitzia. So that means they have three stages here. You have Pekida, which is conception. You have Yitzia, which is birth. And then you have this Yitzira, which is an interim stage during gestation in which the fetus takes on the shape of a body and starts to develop into a shape of a human being. So Rabbi says back to him, Mishat Yitzira. Must be that the Yitzira goes in, Mishat Yitzira. Or in essence, what Rabbi is doing now is, after their previous discussion with Antoninus, he's saying at the earlier period of time, it must be, just like it was in the previous case. That's the case, the child would not stay in utero. The fetus would not be willing to stay there. If the Yitzira was there, he would kick his way out. Mishat Yitzira. Again, it must be at the time that he is born that the Yetzirah enters. The Yetzirah makes the person want to be independent. We just read in Parshat Breshit that the Yetzadat Tov Vera, the Deya, or the understanding, is that the individual now has the capacity to do good and bad, to make choices that go against their creator. That's what Da'at Tov V'ra is. And so to over here, a child that is in utero, if they're given a Yetzirah, that means that they become an independent entity, and they're able to reject that which is given to them, what is taught to them by their parents, or that which is given to them by God. Therefore, the fetus would make a probably poor decision in trying to exercise its rights and independence with the Yetzirah, and try to get out of the mother's womb immediately. It wouldn't stay in there. So therefore, it can't be that the Yetzirah is placed into the individual to a much later time, till after they are born. So Amarabi, Davazelam Deni Antoninus, again, I learned this from Antoninus, Mikra Misayo, and the Pasuk supports him, Shnemar, the Petach Chatat Rovets. He is crouched at the opening. And so that's what they're saying now. At the moment of birth, that's when the Yetzirah is there, again, from this week's Parsha that we just read. Mishlakish Rami Ktiv. Mishlakish says, this is Stira and the Psukim. In Yirmiyahu it says, and this is from the Haftorah on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, where the pasuk begins, and Inim Evi Otam Eretz Zafon, V'kibat Stim Yarkat De'aretz, Bam Iver Pseach Hara, V'yoledet Yachdav. Kal Gadol Yeshuv Heina Uchtiv, the pasuk in Yishayahu says, Az Yidalei Kayal Pseach, V'taron Lashon Ilim, K'nivgu Bamidbar Maim U'nechalim Be'arava. So here it's speaking about Tchiyat HaMetim. In one case, it seems to indicate Bami Ver Pseach. There will be those that are blind, those that were lame. Hara Violedet Yachdav. They will be pregnant and give birth simultaneously, which means that there will no longer be any gestation period. Immediately upon conception, the child will be born. The punishment, the Chava, of extended pregnancy and childbirth will be removed. That curse will be taken back. So therefore, they will have Harabi Oledet. They'll be conceiving and giving birth on the same day. But over there, it seems to indicate that they will still be individuals with Mumim. The other pasuk that we're quoting from Yishayahu is Azi Dalei Kayal Piseach. The flame will be dancing or skipping. The Taron Lashoni Lame, and this song will be heard from the tongue of those that were mute. Kinev Guba Midbar Mayim, because the desert has burst forth with water. And there are rivers that are now flowing in those places that are dry. Is it Lati Lavo that there will be no Mumim? Or there will be Mumim Lati Lavo? How do I reconcile that contradiction in the Psukim? It says, HaKeitzad Umdim Mumman Umitrapim. When Tchiyat HaMetim takes place, they come back with whatever malady or blemish that they had, but then they are cured from that blemish once they have arisen. So there are two stages to this. There's a stage in which they arise in the similar form to where they passed away. But then there is this curative time period that takes place in which after they've come with their mumim, they are then cured of those mumim. And that's how we can reconcile these two psukim. Ula Rami Ktiv. Ula brings the stira from the psukim. Pasuk Yishayahu says, Bila Mavet Lenetzach. Death will be swallowed up forever, will be eliminated. Shem will wipe away all the tears from the faces of an individual. This is a pasuk that they read at many funerals. When they're going to bury the individual, they read this pasuk that Bila Mavet Netzach, that Shem should eliminate death forever and take away the tears from people's eyes. I mean, that's the consolation that we should have, that Shem should eliminate this. Uchtiv. Now here in the Gemara, the pasuk is quoted out of order. But the real pasuk says, Lo yamisham ot ul yamim zakein asher lo yamei et yamav. There will no longer be any youngster or elder individual who will not fulfill his days. Ki anar ben meishna shana yamut. The person who's going to be considered young will die at the age of 100. Bachute ben meishna shana yukulal. And someone who doesn't reach the age of 100 will be cursed as a sinner, because the minimum age, someone who's considered young, would be 100 years. So now, in one place it sounds like there will be no death, Bila Tamava the Netzach. In the other situation says that people will remain young forever, but they will pass away. Lokasha kan Yisrael kan bovde kochavim. Depends, the Jews, Bila Tamava the Netzach, there won't be any death anymore. The non-Jews will remain young, but they will still pass away. Bovde kochavim, amai bayu hatam. That's a really nice answer, but what are the non-Jews doing there at all? Hanach tichtibu. That's speaking about those that it says about them, Vamduzarim, Perutzonchem, ubnei echar, ikarechem, ikormechem. This goes to the argument between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Shimba Yochai in the Gemara in Brachot that discusses Vayayim Shemoa Tishma, that if you listen to what Hashem says, then you will have all your produce and everything that will be good for you. Over there, Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Shimba Yochai argue about what's the proper way to go about it. Shimba Yochai says that if you do what God asks, then you won't have to do anything. All your work will be done by others, and all your produce will be produced by others. You won't have to do anything. So you should dedicate yourself completely to God, because everything will be taken care of by someone else. Bishmal says that many people tried that, but that doesn't work. People have to work. When it's time to work, they got to work to make a living and to do things. Rabbi Shimba Yochai's claim is basically what will be Latid Lavo. That's what Yeshayahu says over here. From Du Zarim, there will be these foreigners, Verutzonchem. They will shepherd your flocks. Ubnei Nechar, and the children of those that are foreign, Ikarechem. Ikar today means a farmer. Over there in Tanakh probably means they'll be your plowmen. Vikormechem, and those that take care of the vineyards. Meaning that they will be Odei Kochavim then, because they will be servicing you. They will be taking care of your physical needs, so that you can dedicate your life to your spiritual needs. Chista Ramik Davi says it's a steer in the psukim. It says, V'chafra ha-levana, u'bosha ha-chama, ki malach Hashem tzvakot. That the moon will be humiliated, and the sun will be shamed, because God has appeared, God is the ruler. The brightness of God as the ruler will be so overwhelming that it will humiliate the moon and shame the sun as if they don't exist. Uchtiv. We have the alternate pasuk there in Yeshayahu that says that the light of the moon will then be like the light of the sun. And then the sun will be sevenfold, like the sun of the original 7 days of creation. So, in one pasuk it says that the sun and the moon will be insignificant. And this pasuk it seems to indicate that they will grow much larger and be much more significant. Lukasha. Kan limot haMashiach, kan liolam haba. So this goes back to what we spoke about a little bit in the introduction, that here the Gemara differentiates between Yimot haMashiach and Olam haba. So that seems to indicate that they are not the same thing. But again, it's not clear, first of all, what is the order of how this happened, as well as what exactly it means, limot haMashiach or liolam haba. As Rashi says over here, Yimot haMashiach, kishiyech la'ashibud. That limot haMashiach is when the shibud is over, haitawar lavanak or haChama. That's when the sun and the moon will expand to be much greater luminaries. Ulatidavo in Olam Haba, where Rashi says that Mirov Nagham Shel Tzadikim, from the great light of the Tzadikim, or the way the Pasuk frames it is, right, the great light of God, they will pale in comparison to the Ziv HaShchinah, the presence of God that's there in Olam Haba. Shmuel Damar, and according to Shmuel Damar, Ein Bein Olam Hazeh Limot Mashiach, Ela Shibud Galiot Bilvad. So now, according to Shmuel, who says that there's no difference between now and Yimot HaMashiach, except Shibud Malchiot, so then it's hard to argue that the luminaries would be bigger at that time. Lokasha, kan b'machane tzadikim, kan b'machane shchinah. Depends where you are. Amongst the tzadikim, the moon and the sun will still have significance, even though the light of the tzadikim will be great. But in the presence of the shchinah, they will pale in comparison. And so therefore, you can't make a distinction, according to Shmuel, between Yimot HaMashiach and Olam Haba, because Yimot HaMashiach doesn't have anything different except Shibud Malchiot. Whereas Olam Haba is a totally new way of being. In that situation, there will be a change in the nature of the moon and the sun. And depending where you look at, if you're with the Tzadikim, then the moon and sun will be significant vis-a-vis the light of the Tzadikim. But in the face of God, the moon and the sun will be insignificant. And this is the position of Shmuel that I've mentioned a number of times, that Shmuel says that there is no difference between today and Yimot HaMashiach, except Shibu Malchut Yubad, which means that Yimot HaMashiach would not be anything of significance in terms of changing the natural order that we have, except for the fact that we have a certain amount of autonomy, and possibly that the Malchut David will be reinstated. Rava Ramiktiv, Rava brings a stira in the psukim. It says, Ani amit v'achayeh. I cause people to die, and I also bring them back to life. Uchtiv, machatzti v'ani erpa. I strike down individuals, and I cure them. So Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, mashi ani memit, ani mechayeh. V'hadar, mashi machatzti, ani erpeh. So he says that it's actually in order. which is similar to what we saw before, which is that there is tchiyat ha-meitim, and in tchiyat ha-meitim people come back with their blemishes or their physical deformities. But then afterwards, Hashem will cure them. So first, Hashem says, that which I caused to die, that which life I took away, echiyah, I will bring them back to life. Once I brought them back to life, then those that were machatzti, those that were struck down, anirpa, I will cure. So once there's already tchiyat ha-meitim, I will also cure those that return in tchiyat ha-meitim. Tana banan, ani emit v'achaye, yachol shutei mita v'achad, v'chayim v'achad, k'derek sh'olam noheg. You would think that some people would die, and some people will come to life. That's the way the world works. People die, people are born. Just like the striking down of the individual, meaning the sickness of the individual, that individual needs the refuah. So over here, we're speaking about the death and the life of a single individual. It means those that died will come back to life. Not that there will be those that die and those that are come to life at the same time, but different individuals. It's the same individual that died will now come back to life, for there will be tchiyat ha-meitim. Mikan, tshuva l'omri, mein tchiyat ha-meitim in Torah. This is a response. There's another proof to the fact that there is tchiyat ha-meitim in Torah, because the nature of the pasuk here that puts meimit and mechayet together, indicating that God will bring back to life those that die, not simply that there will be those that die and those that come to life. When someone dies, someone is born, and there's this replacement factor. It's not that, but actually the same person that died will come back to life, and that's based on its connection to the other part of the pasuk, mechatz tivan erpa. Tanyu, Amar Rabbi Meir, minay l'tchiyat ha-meitim in the Torah. Now we're back to this discussion of how do we know there is tchiyat ha-meitim from the Torah. And again, the Gemara is trying to find something that similarly is a fundamental of our faith that is not explicit in the Torah. Where does the Torah give us indications of the fact that there will be such a thing? Shneemar, Az Yashir Moshe Bnei Yisrael Tashir Azot Hashem. Shar lo neemar, it doesn't say the past tense, this is what they sang, Ela Yashir, that they will sing. Because the Tzkiyat HaMeitim in the Torah. That is proof to Tzkiyat HaMeitim in the Torah. Because they will sing. Az Yashir, they at that point will sing. Not that they did sing at that point. Yosef Bedvar HaTaomer, Az Yivnei Yoshua Mizbeach LaShem. That the instructions that are given in Dvarim to build a Mizbeach at Har Gizim and Har Eval. It says there in Sefer Yoshua, Az Yivnei Yoshua Mizbeach LaShem. Then Yoshua built a Mizbeach LaShem. So there it's in the present perfect. But the way that the Gemara is reading is actually future tense. And so instead of saying, Banalo, Ne'amar doesn't say that he built it, but rather, Ela Yivne, that he will build it in the future. Mikan, Tchiyat HaMeitim in the Torah. Ela Me'ata, now we're going to say, Az Yivne Shlomo B'malich Mosh, Shikutz Moav. What are you going to do now with the pasuk that says, at the end of Shlomo's life, that he built a Mizbeach, a Bama, to Kmosh, who is the Shikutz of Moav. Shikutz Moav is a Lashon Sagi Nor, the god of Moab. They're making fun of it. The disgusting thing of Moab, meaning the god of Moab. Hachinami Diyivne. So now you're going to say the same thing over there. Diyivne means in the future. That's not something positive. When you're talking about something positive, that's fine. When you're talking about something negative, why would you have it in a future tense, indicating that it will happen in the future? Ela male alava katuv ki ilu bana. No, it doesn't mean Yivne, that he will build. But it's as if the Torah assigns the responsibility of the building of the Bama to Shlomo HaMelech. Based on the Midrash Chazal, that Shlomo HaMelech himself was not worshipping the Avodah Zarah, rather it's his wives that were worshipping the Avodah Zarah, but he's assigned responsibility for not stopping them or not eliminating that type of behavior, and that's what it means, Azivneh Shlomo, which is that they are painting Shlomo with the guilt of something done by others, and that's what it means, ki'ilu bana. Even though he didn't build it, as if he did build it. Another proof, says that, lucky are those that get to sit in your dwelling, they will praise you. It doesn't say that they praised you, ela yahalalucha, that they will praise you in the future. Mikan tzkiyat ha-meitim in the Torah. V'amar Rav Yishua ben Levi, kol amir shirav olam hazeh zochem humra le'olam va. Anyone who sings the praises of Hashem in this world will then have the opportunity to sing them in olam haba. Shneemar, Ashrei yoshvei ve'itecha, o jaluch haselah. Lucky are those that sit or dwell in your house, They have another opportunity. They will praise you in the future. Amar Reb Chiya bar Avraham Yochanan minan tzkiyata meitim in haTorah. Where's the source of tzkiyata meitim in haTorah? Shneemar kol tzufayich nasu kol yachtav yiranenu. Voices of your lookouts nasu kol yachtav. They jointly together raise their voices yiranenu to sing the praises of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But again, it says, Rinanu lo ne'amar, doesn't say that they sang the praises of God, El yiranenu, that they will in the future sing the praises of God. Mikans, get them in team in a Torah. Rem Chir Ba'av Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Atidin kol Nevi'im kulan omrim shira b'kol echad. In the future, all the Nevi'im will sing a song together in one voice. Shneamar, kol tzofayich. Tzofayich, many times, tzofeh is used to refer to a Navi. So the voices of the Nevi'im, nasu kol yachtav. They raise their voices together, Yiranenu, and then praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That might also relate to what we saw earlier in the Gemara, that no two Nevi'im give the same Nevuah, because Nevuah is interpretive in nature. And they're giving a dream, or they're giving a Mashal by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they have to interpret it, and each one interprets it independently. But the Atid Lavo, they all will speak with one voice, because then God's appearance, God's presence and appearance will be so obvious and clear, it won't need to be interpretive anymore. It'll be something that everybody has the same vision and direction that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving. Anybody withholds teaching a student a halacha, it's as if he's holding him back from the inheritance of his fathers. The Torah was given to Moshe. Morasha, the word Morasha is hard to translate. We'll loosely translate it here as being an inheritance to the congregation of Yaakov. That's the way the Gemara is learning it over here. Morashahi l'chol Yisrael m'sheshi mei b'reshit. It's an entitlement, the Torah, to all Jews from the beginning of creation. And therefore, if you withhold Torah from an individual, it's as if you're withholding that which he rightfully has or is rightfully entitled to. Rav Chana bar Bizna, Rabbi Shimon Chasida. Anybody withholds Torah from individuals, from Bnei Yisrael, is cursed by even the fetuses that are in utero. The one who holds back grain, then they will be cursed by the Om and the nation. Where it says, and an Om is referring to a fetus. So over there, when Rivka goes to seek counsel of God, when she has the twins, Esav and Yaakov, inside of her, over there it describes the Omil Om Yematz. That, again, there, the meaning of the Omil Om means a nation, which is the Omil Om Yematz. The younger nation will then be stronger and exceed the older one. But the Gemara here is saying that it's referencing to Yaakov and Esav in utero. And therefore, when it says the Omil Om, it's referencing to them inside, the two nations inside of Rivka. Vein kava eleklala, and again the word kava is mean to mean a curse. Nemar makov lo kabokel, that which I cursed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't willing to curse. That's what Bilam says with regards to his cursing of Bnei Yisrael. Vein bar ele Torah, and grain also means Torah. Nemar nashku bar penya enough, they worship in purity, penya enough, lest he become angry. But the way that the Gemara is learning over here is Nashkubar, that they worship through the Torah, or they kiss the Torah, penye enough, so that they do not alter their ways from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ula bar Yishmal omer minakvino to kikvara. They puncture him like a sieve. Tivacha yikvuhu the om. Tivatam vayikov chor bidalto. And there in the Torah, which we read by Parshat Shkalim, where in the time of Yoshiyahu HaMelech, they are putting a stucco box by the Mizbeach, in order to collect the funds to do the maintenance and refurbishing of the Beit HaMikdash, they put a box there and they puncture a hole in it to make it into a stucco box. So there it says, Vayikov Chor, that they punctured a hole. So to over here, Yikavu Elohom means that Hashem will puncture that individual, make them like a sieve. Okay, we're going to stop here, 7 lines down on the top of Tzadi Bet, Amud Aleph.